We'll hear arguments first this morning in three consolidated cases, Bryant against Yellen, California against Yellen, and Imperial Irrigation District against Yellen. Mr. Ely, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I believe that a map has been distributed.
No, I don't have it. It's being distributed now,
thank
Mr.
Ely. The primary question before the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, is whether the Boulder Canyon Project Act, this Court's opinion in Arizona versus California, and its two decrees in that case, require the Secretary of the Interior to deliver water in satisfaction of present perfected rights in excess of 160 acres per owner. If time permits, I will refer also to two other issues in the case, namely the finality that we feel attaches to the conduct of the Department of the Interior and the other judicial approaches to this matter over a period of some 30-odd years, and finally, briefly, the standing of the respondents here. We briefed all three issues, I may say. The area involved in the Imperial Valley, the Court may recall, is below sea level. It was irrigated starting in 1901 by a canal that took off in the United States and followed an ancient river channel through Mexico, the Alamo, it's shown in yellow on this map, and back into the United States. This was done without federal assistance. It continued, the area continued to be irrigated in that fashion for some 40 years. The area under irrigation grew gradually from about 100,000 to the precise figure of 424,145 acres as of the effective date of the Boulder Canyon Project Act, which was June 25, 1929. This Court's decree of last January 1979 so determined, it adjudicated that the present perfected rights, that is, rights to water for a specific area of land, 424,145 acres, had been established under state law by valid appropriations with a priority of 1901, and that the quantity diverted and used in the effective date of the Project Act, 1929, was 2,600,000 acre feet.
Where was that determination?
That's in this Court's decree of January 1979 in Arizona versus California.
That's a supplemental decree that got around to specifying the perfected rights.
That is correct, Mr. Justice White. It determined the present perfected rights of some 17 defined tracts of land in Arizona and 59 in California. Of the area in Imperial Irrigation District, it is stipulated that 233,000 acres are in holdings in excess of 160 acres. There are 800 such holdings in the district. This came about because prior to the time when the Boulder Canyon Project Act was enacted, the economy of the valley had established that pattern. Lands had originally been acquired under the Desert Land Act in tracts of 320 acres, not 160 acres, and over the years had been consolidated as the laws of California and indeed the United States permitted, with the result that as of 1929 and now, the economy of the valley is reflected in holdings larger than 160 acres.
Mr. Ely,
yes.
To whom did the the perfected right run? That's relevant to this case.
Yes, the decree, the 1979 decree, decreed these rights to Imperial Irrigation District. I should add that under the laws of California, the district is a trustee for the landowners who are the equitable owners of the water rights. The district cannot sell them, it cannot mortgage them under California law. It is a trustee.
What standing does the state law have under the reclamation laws?
The Boulder Canyon Project Act and this court's 1964 decree, I should say, define present perfected rights as rights acquired under state law and perfected by the application of a specific quantity of water to a defined area of land by the effective date of the Project Act. The court, in its definition, adopted a state law as a key to the magnitude and priority of the present perfected right. The problem here arises primarily from Section 6 of the Boulder Canyon Project Act, read in connection with Section 14. Section 6 directed the Secretary of the Interior to so operate Hoover Dam and Lake Mead as to satisfy three functions. First, flood control, navigation and flood control. Second, irrigation and domestic uses. And the satisfaction of present perfected rights pursuant to Article 8 of the Colorado River Compact. Article 8 of the Colorado River Compact declared that present perfected rights are unimpaired by this compact. It did not define the term, but the legislative history makes it, as reported to Congress during the Project Act debates, makes it very clear that the present perfected rights being talked about are the very ones involved here. Imperial Irrigation District representatives appeared before Mr. Hoover and the commissioners and demanded protection if there was going to be an interstate allocation of water. Article 8 refers to the very lands involved here. The rights were perfected by the application of water to these same lands, the 233,000 acres of excess lands. This is well known to Congress. During the course of the debates on the Boulder Canyon Project Act, you may recall there were four swing Johnson bills, the question arose as to whether the land limitations of the reclamation law, 160 acres per owner, should apply to these lands. And the decision was plainly that they should not. There were no less than five efforts made in the two houses to add a specific section to the Project Act which would have extended the 160-acre limitation to these lands, and each of these failed. A House committee included such language in one bill. The House, the Senate, when it passed its bill, omitted it. Three times in the Senate, Senators Phipps, Hayden, Ashurst offered amendments to do this. Each of these was abandoned because it had no support. The law as enacted does not contain any specific acreage limitation on the present perfected rights. It does contain, in Section 14, a direction that this act shall be deemed a supplement to the reclamation law, which shall govern the construction, operation, and maintenance of the project, except as otherwise provided in this act. And the question is whether this cross-reference to the reclamation law somehow overrode Section 16's mandate to satisfy present perfected rights. Now, the consequence, if it did, is that the Secretary cannot deliver water to some 233,000 acres that this Court has adjudicated to be within the 424,000 enjoined present perfected rights.
Well, they could deliver it if the land was in 160... all held by persons owning no more than 160 acres?
Well, if the equitable owner of the water right is compelled to sell, the effect, according to our opponent's briefs, is this. The land carries with it no present perfected right. It must be sold at desert land prices, $25 to $50 per acre, or revert to desert. Now, you may or may not agree with that being the consequence of the statute, but that's what our opponents say, and that's the basis upon which the Ninth Circuit decided the case.
Under that approach, it's a truism to say that the landowner could sell no water.
Well, that is correct. He is stripped of it, and if there can be a greater impairment than a reduction of the water right to zero, it's hard to imagine it. It's alleged, and the argument is made, that the land is worth $1,200 to $1,400 per acre irrigated, It's been irrigated for 50 years now or more. And as but it would have to be sold stripped of its water right at desert land prices.
Mr. Ely, are you going to address the question of standing, or is your colleague?
I will touch on that, no doubt, Mr. Vanderbilt, too. Would you like for me to turn to that?
That's your...
The Judge Turrentine in the district court decided against the United States. This was an action brought by the government to require or an injunction against the Imperial Irrigation District to require it to cease deliveries to water in excess of 160 acres. After a trial, Judge Turrentine decided against the United States in a well-considered opinion in which he said it was repugnant to the mandate that water be delivered in satisfaction of present perfected rights to say that water should be withheld from 233,000 acres enjoying such rights. The United States did not appeal. Solicitor General Griswold, in a memorandum for his files, which has just been made public, just made available to us last February 20 by publication in the Congressional Record, and which is annexed to our reply brief in full, gave his reasons for not doing so, for declining.
What was the fulcrum by which that letter was published in the Congressional Record?
It was placed in the Congressional Record by Senator Nelson. And I don't know the circumstances under which he came in possession of it. In any event, he referred, Mr. Griswold, to the fact that this question had been considered and decided by Secretary Wilbur of the Department of the Interior in 1933, and he had decided that under the reclamation law, the standing practice of the law dating at least from 1910, and the legislative history of the Boulder Canyon Project Act, the excess land laws were not intended to apply here. Secretary, I'm digressing slightly from the standing issue, but not much, Mr. Chief Justice. Secretary Ickes followed him and came to the same conclusion. There is pending a confirmation proceeding in the state court as required by the federal law of 43 U.S.C. 511. And as required by the contract, to determine the validity of this contract. This is coming to trial on March 9. Secretary Wilbur went out of office March 4. In February, in response to inquiries from the district as to whether he would inform the court of what his decision had been, he wrote a letter which was submitted to the court, which said that early in the negotiations, it had been a determination had been reached that I've just described. This had been some 13 months earlier that this conclusion had been reached. The Mr. Griswold refers to all this in his memorandum and to the fact that five succeeding secretaries adhered to this ruling as a good reason why it was not in the interest of good government for the United States to appeal.
Mr. Ely, do you regard this interpretation of the secretary as the kind of interpretation described by Justice Jackson's opinion in Skidmore versus in Swift Company, where the secretary is not authorized specifically to make rules, but is the one charged with administering the statute and follows an administrative practice?
Well, I would think so, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. We have relied on the Norwegian fertilizer case, which refers to the responsibility of an administrative officer who is in charge of the responsibility of putting a statute in motion, and this is exactly what happened. I'll stay with the standing problem and come back to what I was about to say. After the United States had decided not to appeal, a group headed by Dr. Yellen, 123 individuals, acting in their own name and not as a class action, moved for leave to intervene to appeal. Judge Turrentine denied that motion. It was reversed by the Ninth Circuit. The appeal was entertained. The United States did not participate. And the Ninth Circuit decided this case against the district, against the landowners, holding that the present perfected rights were not a bar to the application of the 160-acre rule. I may say that this case had been started in 1967 After this court's opinion and first decree in Arizona versus California had come down, the Ninth Circuit didn't regard this as conclusive at all. It was relying primarily on an opinion of a solicitor named Frank Berry, issued in 1964, after the court's opinion and decree had come down, and it never mentions either one of them. And it held that all the secretaries before Secretary Udall had been wrong. These were Wilbur originally, followed in his. The other secretaries didn't undertake to determine the merits, but simply regarded this matter as settled. These were Krug, Chapman, Seaton, and so on. And now we know from Solicitor General Grizzle's memorandum that Secretary Morton also agreed. So altogether, there are seven secretaries in five presidential administrations who followed this rule, that the economy existing in 1929 was not meant to be dismantled and destroyed by a statute that directed that these same perfected rights be served and not taken.
When Yellen and his group sought to intervene, did they make a commitment to buy or tender any money that obligated them in any way to buy?
No, Mr. Chief Justice.
They just said...
They said that they couldn't
buy
at $1,400 an acre. They expected to be able to buy at lower prices the Secretary would set. They said the value of the land as desert is $25 to $50 an acre, which means a windfall of perhaps $200,000 per 160-acre tract to the buyer. I may say that he can resell at once under the law. There's no limitation on him. But he can resell at full market price, not the desert land price.
Well, would not the owner, confronted with that situation, be also free to sell to anyone of his own choice?
The former owner?
The man who had more than 160.
He would be limited altogether to 160 acres.
Yes, but could he sell the excess to anyone he wanted,
no.
Not to Yellen?
Yes, he could. He could.
Desert land prices.
Desert land prices. There's no assurance at all that Dr. Yellen would be the lucky buyer. If the honey pot is this big and this good, I suppose there'd be hundreds of thousands of bidders, literally from all over the country.
Doesn't that have something to do with his standing to... intervene in this case?
Well, we think so, Mr. Chief Justice. It's the irony is intensified by the fact that the very same group had brought a suit in district court to enforce the residency requirements of the reclamation law, and that had been decided in their favor and was appealed by the United States. And that case was decided by the Ninth Circuit, and the same opinion that decided this held that the same group did not have standing to enforce the residency requirement, because there's no assurance that they would be the lucky buyers. But it turned right around and held they did have standing in this matter. Now, there's one added item on standing, Mr. Chief Justice. The statute under which this action is brought, which is Section 46 of the 1926 Omnibus Adjustment Act, provides that the Secretary's authority to fix the price on resale, that is on sale by the excess lands by the original owner, shall expire when the one-half of the debt to the United States had been paid. Now, that happened while the case was on appeal. The Imperial Irrigation District succeeded in repaying more than one-half of the original debt to the government. So if the Yellen Group ever had standing, it disappeared when the Secretary lost his authority to fix the price on the sale of the excess lands. Now, this is brushed aside by the Ninth Circuit on rehearing. But we say they never had standing. If they did, they lost it. And if the Yellen Group didn't have standing to to file an appeal from the judgment against the United States, that judgment remains res judicata against the United States in the district court. The case should not have been in the Court of Appeals. It shouldn't be here. It hinges entirely on whether these private parties had competence to intervene, to overrule the decision of the Solicitor General that this case in the public interest should not be appealed. If this is possible in this case, I don't know where you draw the line as to the right or power of an individual.
I suppose if we agreed with you on standing, we would just vacate the judgment of the Ninth Circuit, which would leave the district court's judgment standing. But a judgment that wouldn't bind anybody but the It would bind the United States, but would it bind some other people who?
Well, it would bind the United States, I think, be very difficult.
If somebody else could convince the court that he had standing to challenge this this holding, I suppose the judgment wouldn't bind him.
I suppose somebody
would look around for someone like that, since they would know what the attitude of the Ninth Circuit is.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. We would hope that the court would decide in our favor on the merits. If it does not, then the course indicated by Mr. Justice White is the alternative, we feel.
Mr. Ely, one other question on standing. Did the government complaint ask for an order compelling any landowner to sell his property?
No, Mr. Justice Stevens. It is conceded by the government that the secretary cannot compel a landowner to sell.
So we have to assume that there would be voluntary sales at desert land prices in order to support standing.
That is the assumption. Yeah. And this means that a man who, on the day before the Project Act took effect, June 24, 1929, who had a 480-acre farm, would wake up 2 days later and discover that he had water rights for 160 acres. He hasn't had a water right at all for 320 acres for the last 50 years. Now, this, in the face of determinations by seven successive secretaries, to the contrary. It seems an extraordinary result.
Mr. Ely, yes.
Do you concede that a different rule prevails in the other valley,
Coachella? Yes, sir. Coachella had never had any perfected rights. It had never diverted water from the Colorado River. It was like the two districts in Ivanhoe who had had no rights in the water at all, and the United States was at liberty to condition its sale of water.
They just came in and contracted for some water.
Well,
they didn't come in and say we have rights to water. They came in and bought some.
That
water.
Is correct. The court's opinion in Arizona versus California draws a bright line between two classes of water rights. Present perfected rights. The United States never owned, had nothing to sell. It's told to serve, and contract rights acquired by contract with the United States. And these, the court held, could be allocated by the secretary. He could choose the taker. He could make an interstate allocation. He could make an intrastate allocation. But not so as to present perfected rights. In some 10 references to the present perfected rights, which we have collected in the appendix to our reply brief, the court said the secretary is fettered with respect to these, that they are one of the most important limitations in the act, or of vast importance to those who would reduce the water, pardon the possession. So that the 3 points,
the United States isn't suggesting that the water to the irrigation district just refused to deliver water to anybody who owns more than 160 acres, but then sales took place. The irrigation district would have the water to deliver to anybody who owns 160 acres.
Yes. The contention is that if the landowners decide not to sell for $25 or $50 an acre, but to wait for a better day, that the district can redistribute that water to others. It can't for two reasons. One, the legal one I mentioned, it's only a trustee. It can't redistribute water appurtenant to the land. And second, there's no place to put it. All of the irrigable land in Imperial Irrigation District private land is now being irrigated. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The central issue in this case, as Mr. Ely has made clear, is what Congress intended in 1928 when it passed the Boulder Canyon Project Act. There is somewhat of an unreal quality about that question, because we know that its answer is one that in a true historical sense we can't divine today. No one today has the capacity to look back 50 years and say with certitude what Congress intended in 1928. The legislative history which has been itemized in the briefs, seems to indicate almost overwhelmingly that there was no intention to impose acreage limitation. But even with that evidence, we can't be certain. We're engaging in some reasoned conjecture when we as counsel assert what's clear and what's not clear. But there is in this case a core of fact that we don't have to conjecture about, we don't have to speculate about. And it's really the essence of this case. And it's the human experience of what happened after 1928, beginning with Secretary Wilbur's ruling, the judicial proceedings in Hughes, and the lives that the people of the Imperial Valley built on that foundation. That human experience is the essence of this case, not a bunch of postulating about what Congress may or may not have intended. That human experience is what should be controlling in this case, I suggest, not syllogisms about statutory syntax. The fundamental practical fact of the matter is that the contemporaneous construction of this act, which was begun in 1931 when the government negotiated the contract with the valley, is the bedrock upon which this valley's economy and legal order has been based for almost 50 years. That bedrock started when the contract was negotiated. It was perpetuated when the electors of the district approved the contract. It was solidified when Secretary Wilbur ruled that acreage limitation did not apply. It was further solidified when the contract was placed in judicial proceedings, the matter was put in issue, and it was adjudged that acreage limitation did not apply. Now, those events aren't conjectural. Those are the bedrock events in this valley's life. And we're not dealing with a situation where we have an administrative construction that you can overrule prospectively with only minimal impact on people's lives.
Well, counsel, there is the general rule that if the administrative construction is totally wrong, the government is not stopped in the way an ordinary party is by a long, even a fairly long history of wrong construction if the courts determine that it was just flatly wrong.
That's correct, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but the premise of that rule, it seems to me, is that the court will uphold the status quo unless the matter is free from doubt, unless there can be no reasoned argument in support of the status quo.
So you say that, in effect, Secretary Wilbur's letter is a permissible construction of the statute, even though perhaps not the only one.
That is right. And it is permissible because of the language of the statute, because of what transpired in Congress when Reclamation Commissioner Meade said acreage limitation would not apply, because of what happened in Congress when Congressman Swing said acreage limitation would not apply. There's a whole host of grounds upon which one can base Secretary Wilbur's construction, including the governmental practice, which was embodied in regulations at that time, dating back to 1906, of respecting vested rights. The administrative practice in this case has given rise to reliance that is widespread and not conjectural, and the reliance of private individuals in this case is awesome in its dimensions. Since the 1930s, virtually every transfer of land in this valley has assumed the validity of what Secretary Wilbur said and what the Hughes Court said. Virtually every family that farms in the valley today has at one time or another committed the bulk of its resources to acquiring farmland at market prices, reflecting the land's assumed entitlement to a perpetual supply of water. Farmers have made enormous investments in subsurface drainage tile, concrete-lined ditches, leveling their lands, purchasing equipment, all premised on what has to be one of the most fundamental expectations human beings can have in an agricultural community: the assumed security of the water rights appurtenant to the land. and you have literally hundreds of human arrangements that have been built on this bedrock, testamentary trusts, inter vivos trusts, mortgage financings, estate plans, all of which would be unwound if today we deny the legitimacy of the status quo. I would like to refer to one example to give you a feel for the concrete facts in this case, and that is the situation of petitioner Charles Nielsen, who appeared at trial and testified. Mr. Nielsen was born in this valley. He lived on a 130-acre farm his father homesteaded in 1907. When he graduated from high school in the valley, he went into the service in World War II. He came out. He and his two brothers joined in partnership to begin farming. Over the years, they put together a 970-acre tract in which Mr. Nielsen owns one-third interest, and that's his excess acreage. Throughout the 1940s and the 50s, they acquired this tract in little bits and pieces. It was land which, during the Depression, had gone out of production because it was salt poisoned, virtually worthless. They acquired it, as best they could afford it, in $10 and $15 an acre prices. It took them, on an average, 5 years per 160 acres to bring that land into production. They had to deep plow it to a depth of 4 feet. They had to do that twice. They had to install tile drainage. That land today is what it is because of that man's life. Its value is because of what he put in it, not because of governmental beneficence. And that illustrates another fact in this case. And that is that those who would like to acquire Mr. Nielsen's land at $25 an acre don't really have any fundamental equities in support of the opportunity they seek. They haven't detrimentally relied on the past. They haven't detrimentally relied on an expectation that the past will be rewritten. They haven't relied on Mr. Nielsen. They just want an opportunity. So what's really at stake here is not an abstract proposition, but a very practical, realistic thing as to who's going to own this land, who's going to farm it. Those who have reclaimed it and farmed it are someone new.
Is Mr. Nielsen typical of the owners?
Yes, Your Honor. We brought before the court 9 owners. 2 have since deceased. The 7 remaining live in the valley, farm in the valley, have lived there all of their lives, with one exception, 2 exceptions, of gentlemen who came to the valley after college or after high school to establish their careers there.
Well, are the 9 typical of owners who would be benefited if you prevail here?
Yes, Your Honor. They represent a class, and there are approximately, according to the record, it's a stipulated fact, 800 such ownerships. Now, the 800 ownerships are, of course, combined into a smaller number of farms, as in Mr. Nielsen's situation, where you have really 3 ownerships, which he and his brothers each own one-third interest, so they have 3 ownerships, but they run their farm together as Nielsen Brothers Farm, farming their land and their father's 130 acres. A final and, I think, most practical consideration in this case is the contemporaneous vantage point from which those who construed the Act originally made their decisions. We can't recreate that vantage point today. We cannot duplicate their perspective of what contemporary policy was or what happened in the Swing-Johnson proceedings. Now, these people weren't, ignorant officials. Porter Dent, who wrote Secretary Wilbur's ruling, was the chief counsel of the Bureau of Reclamation, a career government attorney who had been chief counsel of the Bureau of Reclamation since 1924. His career as the Bureau's chief officer spanned the last 4 years of the debates in the Swing-Johnson bills. He was the foremost legal authority in his day on reclamation law. He directed the compilation of the textbook on reclamation law. His immediate superior was Dr. Elwood Mead. Dr. Mead was one of the founders of the project. He served on the All-American Canal Board in 1919, which first recommended it. He was the government's principal witness in the Swing-Johnson hearings. And he was intimately familiar with acreage limitation policy.
It's Lake Mead named after him.
Yes, Your Honor. He served on the Fact Finders Board in 1924, which made the recommendations on acreage limitation policy that were ultimately embodied in Section 46 of the 1926 Act. He was the government's principal witness in the hearings preceding that enactment. If anybody knew what acreage limitation policy was, it was Dr. Elwood Mead. And clearly, if Dr. Elwood Mead had thought that non-application of acreage limitation was an affront to national policy or reclamation law, he would have said so in Congress. But he stood in Congress with Congressman Swing and said, this act will not apply to acreage limitation. And clearly, if he thought that what he was saying was an affront to national policy, he would hardly have arranged for the Bureau's counsel to assist the district in defending against the allegations made in the Hughes proceeding about the 160-acre limitation question. When that question arose in litigation in 1933, Dr. Mead arranged for the government to send counsel to help on that issue. Clearly, if anyone had thought, if there had been any serious thought by these men who knew what acreage limitation policy was, that the Wilbur ruling was wrong, these events couldn't have happened. And that is pure, plain fact, which we can't escape from today. We can stand here today as latter-day historians and speculate about what administrative practice was in the 30s or the 20s or about what Congress intended. But Mead and Dent didn't have to speculate. They took part in the events of the day. They knew what the events of the day were. And their interpretation as a real, practical matter is far more likely to reflect the reality of what Congress intended in 1928 than any hypothesis constructed by counsel today, whether as counsel for petitioners or respondents. Now, in circumstances like these, where there's every practical reason to respect the past, we come to the pragmatic test which Mr. Justice Rehnquist referred to. It's a test this Court has always applied. It says that every reasonable doubt should be given to the status quo if there's any basis in reason for argument in support of the status quo, it should be followed. This Court said in United States v. Midwest Oil, that is a wise and quieting rule. It's a necessary rule if government is to remain a practical affair intended for practical men. And I would submit that that same thought was what Solicitor General Griswold expressed in 1971 when he made his decision not to authorize an appeal of the case. He said the essence of this case is essentially a question of good administration of the government.
What was the occasion, for the reexamination of the question in the Department of Interior in 1964?
The occasion arose in 1964 hearings in April. Associate Solicitor Weinberg and the Secretary were before Congress, a Senate committee on irrigation, considering a plan which called for use of 1.3 million acre-feet of Colorado River water in Arizona and the bringing of water from the Northwest into the California to replace that. And Senator Kuchel asked what law would apply to that new water brought in from the Northwest. Solicitor Weinberg said the Boulder Canyon Project Act. Senator Kuchel said, would the acreage limitation apply? And Mr. Weinberg said, I don't know. Senator Anderson said, well, it clearly wouldn't. It hasn't applied in California. Mr. Weinberg said, well, it may have to be litigated. I don't know the answer to it. Now, I would suggest to Your Honors that that's a very revealing incident. If this law were so clear that it couldn't be said, if it were as clear as Solicitor Berry contended, if there were no reasonable arguments any place for the historic construction, I can't understand why Mr. Weinberg stood before Congress and said he didn't know the answer.
Well, I suppose that this Court had already heard twice heard opinions
from the Solicitor General about this matter, hadn't it?
Solicitor General Rankin.
Yes, you heard about it in the footnote in Solicitor General Rankin's brief. You've heard about it from Solicitor General Griswold, and we'll hear about it from Solicitor General McCree. It's a matter about which, at best, there is, you know, dispute, doubt, and debate. It isn't clear one way or the other. All that is clear...
Well, Solicitor General Rankin thought it was clear, didn't he? Or did he?
I'm not sure. He asserted it, Your Honor.
On two occasions, didn't he?
One occasion is the only one I'm aware of, Your Honor. I might be wrong, though. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal remarks. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Solicitor General.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the government views this case as essentially one of statutory construction, requiring the Court to decide whether the Congress intended to exempt the Boulder Canyon project from the excess acreage limitation that has been an important part of reclamation law since the enactment of the Reclamation Act of 1902. Central to legislation to dispose of the public lands has been a commitment to attempt to establish an independent yeomanry of small family farms. This was first evidenced as early as 1862 in the Homestead Act, which provided an acreage limitation of 160 for a single holding. But it soon became evident that this acreage limitation would not apply in the arid lands, as the plain states were occupied, because 160 acres was too small a holding for grazing, and the average homesteader lacked the capital resources to permit irrigation. There was a short-lived Desert Land Act of 1897 with an expanded maximum acreage allowance of 640 acres, but this was abused when speculators began to amass large tracts by what has been characterized by one writer as fraudulent evidence of water having been brought onto the land. Someone would bring a pail of water and spill it, and an affidavit would follow, and the land would be given to the speculator. With this prelude, and against the backdrop of the drought decade of 1886, the Reclamation Act of 1902 was enacted, with a limitation of 160 acres as the maximum amount of private land in single ownership that is eligible to receive water from a reclamation project. The Reclamation Act was amended and strengthened in a series of successive statutes that culminated in the Omnibus Adjustment Act of 1926, Section 46 of which provided in part that no water should be delivered upon the completion of a new project until a contract should have been entered into between the Secretary of the Interior and an irrigation district, providing for repayment of the project cost and providing for recordable contracts to be entered into by the holders of excess acreage, that is to say, acreage in excess of 160 acres, for an appraisal of the excess by the secretary and an agreement by the owner of the excess to dispose of this property under terms fixed by the secretary and at prices not to exceed the appraised value. I think we would differ with my brother, who has argued earlier, and perhaps with the respondents who will follow us in this respect. We read Section 46 to provide that the secretary should not appraise it at the desert price, as was stated, but at a price that would not take cognizance of the improvement of the project. And in the case of the Imperial Valley, where there was water previous to the Boulder project, that would be the value of the land. The land favored by that water, or irrigated by that water, which would be less, we submit, than the value of the land receiving the Boulder Dam water, which was more regular, more dependable, and not subject to the vagaries of our foreign affairs with our neighbor to the south.
And the water, I take it that you say the land already had before the project is precisely the adjudicated perfected right.
The adjudicated perfected right. That's right, if the court please.
And you say that would the value of that water would be attributed to the land that somebody would be required to sell.
That is our reading of this requirement.
In which event you say that
which makes the windfall not as great.
Well, which also says that the landowner is entitled to the water.
It's not exactly. It says
he gets to sell it.
But the land will be appraised according to its value as irrigated by that water.
So the water follows the land. And the water follows the land, and the owner gets the value of the water. He gets the value of the land as irrigated land.
As it was irrigated under the Alamo Canal.
Yeah, but that's which is the presently perfected right that was adjudicated.
But the water that's received now is different from, and in many respects, in the form and manner in which it is delivered, from the water that was received earlier.
But the amount you're talking about is the presently perfected right that was adjudicated.
The presently perfected right is the water
to which
the irrigation district is entitled. There's no question about that. Yes,
and each owner is entitled to be paid for his share of it.
Each owner is entitled to have his land appraised for the purpose of Section 46 of the Omnibus Act according to its value before the Boulder project was completed.
Well, and the difference, General McCree, that you're referring to is basically efficiency and certainty of delivery of the water rather than the creation of new water rights, isn't it?
That's correct. And I think it's significant here to consider what happened before the Boulder Project was enacted. Judge Wallenberg recounts this history in his opinion, the opinion which is before the court now. And, of course, the Colorado River, as it flowed south roughly along the boundary of Arizona and California, flowed into Mexico and through Mexico into the Gulf of California. Through the efforts of the predecessors of the Imperial Irrigation District, some of its water was diverted into a dry riverbed, the Alamo River, which proceeded west and then northerly into what is now the Imperial Valley, where there was a decline of the land northward, and it irrigated that valley before this project works, the Boulder Dam, now the Hoover Dam, and Lake Mead and the other project works were established. These lands received that water prior to this project, but not under the circumstances they receive it now. As a matter of fact, I'm sure the court is familiar with the history of this project. When in 1905, the Colorado River breached its banks and flowed north in such abundance that it almost washed out the Imperial Valley, went into the Salton Sink and created the current Salton Sea, 333,000 acres of water. And this still persists since 1905. Then there were drought periods where there was no water available to the lands, and the uncertainty of having the lands flooded as dramatically as they were when the Salton Sea was created, or dry because the river was not dependable during the summer months, is the difference between what this project meant to the Imperial Valley and what was there previous to its enactment.
Suppose, Mr. Solicitor General, suppose that the irrigation district, just suppose that it had title to all the land at the time that the Boulder Canyon Project Act was passed at the time the at the time of the adjudication of the presently perfected right, suppose all the land was in one ownership. You would be here and taking the same position, I suppose.
I think we would take the same position based on the statute.
So it really doesn't make any difference that the land is in a variety of ownerships and that the perfected right was adjudicated to the district.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
The right is the right of the district and not the individual owners.
Well, but it doesn't make any difference which one it is, because you would take the same position even if it was all in one ownership.
Yes, because the Section 46 of the Omnibus Adjustment Act provided that no water should be delivered from a reclamation project to any single ownership exceeding 160 acres.
And the district holds as trustee for the various landowners, does it not?
This is our understanding of the law.
Mr. Solicitor General, suppose man now had 640 acres. And before this case is decided, he sells three tracts of 160 each to three qualified eligible purchasers, that leases back all of the land sold and continues his operation as before. Would that be permissible?
Where there is Mr. Chief Justice, the statute provides. This is Section 46 of the Omnibus Adjustment Act, that upon proof of fraudulent representation, the Secretary of the Interior is authorized to cancel water rights. So well, whether...
My hypothetical is that there's no fraud. He sells it to three different owners, each of whom will have 160, and each of them leases back to him on a legitimate lease.
I want to think about that. The impact of the excess acreage requirement isn't as draconian as it sounds. For example, a husband and wife can each have 160 acres and work that land together, and they would be entitled to receive water from a reclamation project. A family with adult children might be permitted to have 160 acres for each spouse and each child who was a resident and who worked the land. The Secretary of the Interior has also applied the 160-acre limitation to cover a trust where a trustee holds land for more than one beneficiary, and each beneficiary can have land up to 160 acres.
But how do we know that some subsequent secretary won't come along and say, just as Secretary Udall did, that this 30-year construction of the Act is wrong and we're now going to change it?
We have this assurance that after the breakup of the excess acreage and after more than one half, or at least one half, of the project works have been paid for, the price limitation does not apply to subsequent sales of the property. And the statute so provides also in Section 46 of the Omnibus Adjustment Act of 1926.
And my hypothetical, and part of the assumption is that it's a legitimate transaction, all on top of the table. You could lease back, the one person could lease back three other 160-acre tracts from his vendee.
Well, I know of no prohibition against that. I can't direct you to a statute that would forbid that.
Would that be a matter for the Secretary to...
That would be a matter for the Secretary to handle, as we understand. But we... Yes,
Mr. Justice. As to the government's understanding of the meaning of Section 46, do I correctly understand that it's your view that the Secretary of the Interior did not have, by reason of this statute, did not have the... legal authority to enter into a contract with the Imperial District? The contract itself should not have been entered into at all.
That is not our position. He had authority to enter into a contract with the Imperial District. There's no question about his having that authority. We contend that the contract should have provided for the excess acreage limitation.
But it didn't.
It did not.
Doesn't the statute, in your reading of it, flatly prohibit the contract that he made? It says no water shall be delivered and so forth.
Well, it doesn't prohibit the making of the contract, but it would prohibit the delivery of the water pursuant to such a contract. That's correct.
So that it isn't merely the Wilbur letter, but it's the fact that they've been delivering water pursuant to an understanding of the statute with which you disagree for all these years.
Since the project began in the early 1930s.
Yeah. I mean, really, the case would be precisely the same even if Mr. Wilbur had never written a letter, because you still have the position taken by the government of the United States on which everybody acted because of their reading of the statute.
But an effort was subsequently made to have the contract amended to conform with the statute.
Now, when was that?
This was first about 1964, I believe. Efforts were made to have the contract reformed to comply with the statute. But from about 1931 until 1964, we submit that the administration of the waters from this Boulder project was contrary to congressional authorization.
But the government wants to keep the money that was paid.
Pardon me?
Wasn't money paid pursuant to this contract?
Free water.
The water was not paid for.
No, but I
the irrigation district was required to pay for the construction of the All-American Canal, but the fact of the matter is the All-American Canal had several power drops along the way, and the electricity that was generated in these power drops was attributed to its share of the cost of the project works, with the consequence that they've paid nothing for this water, which has created the most desirable farmland, certainly in that part of the country, if not in the entire country. It hasn't cost anything, and we say this for their assertion of reliance and their detrimental reliance and the dire consequences it would result.
Well, suppose the All-American Canal had been built before the Boulder project, and they had been using it, and that water had been running through it.
It could have been expressly
exempted. The fact is that the district was entitled to the water.
But it could have been expressly exempted, and as this court said in Ivanhoe Irrigation, where a particular project has been exempted because of its peculiar circumstances, the Congress has always made such an exemption by express enactment. And that would have been the thing to do, because they're not going to build a project where one is not required, and
but
one would not have been required.
But the government construction of the statute for 30 years was contrary to your present submission.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it. But we say it was wrong. It was contrary to the direction of the Congress.
General McCree, you cite in your brief Justice Jackson's opinion for the court in Skidmore versus Swift and Company about administrative construction, and page 140 of 323 U.S. in that case, the court's opinion contains the statement, good administration of the act and good judicial administration alike require that the standards of public enforcement and those for determining private rights shall be at variance only where justified by very good reasons. Don't you have to take the position that Secretary Wilbur's letter was almost irrational in order to maintain the position you're now maintaining?
I don't think we have to characterize it that far, because we do say that it is contrary to the congressional direction. Mr. Justice Frankfurter said once in Hensley versus Union Planters Bank that wisdom sometimes never comes, so we should not reject it just because it comes late.
Well, 30 years is 30 years of congressional inaction after Wilbur's letter is quite significant, isn't it?
It is significant, but we still say that their remedy is in the Congress and not in the court. And Judge Wallenberg, writing for the Ninth Circuit, recognized that in the opinion below, which we respectfully urge this court to affirm.
Well, let's just assume for the moment that you agreed that the statute could be construed, could reasonably be construed
A or reasonably construed B. And for 30 years it had been construed A, but the government now preferred to construe it B. What would your position?
If I make that assumption, I would agree, I think, with the conclusion that you would draw. But I don't make that assumption.
Exactly. I understand you don't.
Because the statute...
You think it's so clearly wrong that that 30 years of error should be corrected?
Should be corrected because there's been a...
Sort of like the income tax.
There's...
Well, 100 years of error.
I don't find anything in the Omnibus Adjustment Act that gives me any encouragement in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Brunwasser.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case concerns the applicability of the anti-monopoly provisions of reclamation law to the Imperial Valley of California. The outcome will determine if the vast benefits of the reclamation program will inure forever to owners of hundreds and thousands of acres of land, or if these benefits will be restricted to the persons who live and farm and work on family-sized farms, as intended by Congress in 1902 when the Reclamation Act was passed. The subsidy involved in this case is far different from any other subsidy which probably has ever come before this Court and which has been considered by the government. Aside from the dollar value of each year's supply of water deliveries, the subsidy here is continuous. It has been provided for the past 40 years and will continue to be provided so long as the Colorado River flows.
Is there something in the nature of a subsidy lurking in the windfall that was referred to earlier by the Solicitor General and others for the purchasers who acquire the property at a...
Mr. Chief Justice?
At a modest price?
Mr. Chief Justice, Congress intended a subsidy and a windfall. And Congress intended that subsidy and that windfall go to small farmers because of a number of reasons which form part of the fabric of legislation intended to protect small family farmers as developed in the amicus brief that's been filed in this Court. There's nothing wrong with subsidies per se, but Congress intended that subsidy be used for a specific purpose to create a class of small family farmers, not large farmers. Small farmers.
Would you disagree then with at least the Solicitor General's tentative response to my hypothetical that one individual, a bachelor, no wife, no children, could dispose of all of his acreage in excess of 160 and lease it back? He wouldn't be a very small farmer anymore, would he?
Well, the answer to that question, Mr. Chief Justice, is this. There are proposed regulations to cover this very point, which are set out in the appendix to the district's brief. And the Secretary of the Interior has proposed that there be a limit to the amount of acreage which may be leased. There's a limit of 160 acres may be leased. In addition, the landowner, as I understand it, may own 160 acres. The problem that Your Honor has put his finger on is a problem that has plagued the reclamation program from the very beginning. Your Honor may know that at this very moment on Capitol Hill, there is a bill, S-14, which was approved by the Senate and is now before the House. And one of the biggest battles over changing the reclamation program was over the question of leasing. How much land should a landowner be allowed to lease without violating the excess land laws? The answer is that the Secretary has discretion under Section 10 of the Reclamation Act to adopt rules and regulations to carry out the policies of the law. Clearly, the policy of the law, as enunciated by Congress and as approved by this Court in Ivanhoe, is that there be small family farms of 160 acres. Now, if the situation arises where there is an effort to lease more than 160 acres or 1,000 acres or more, then that is a matter under present law for the Secretary of Interior to adjudicate at the first instance. If he acts unreasonably and beyond the scope of his authority, that matter would assumably come before the courts.
What is the thrust of the pending legislation that you referred to?
Number one, insofar as this case is concerned, it's to delete Any applicability of the acreage limitation and the residency requirement of reclamation law to the Imperial Valley of California. Number two, it's to enlarge the acreage limitation from anywhere, I think the lowest figure is about 640 acres to 1,280 acres. Third, it's to delete the residency requirement completely. In effect, the landowners of the Imperial Valley have asked Congress to do what their counsel have been asking the federal courts to do since this case began in 1967. And I might point out that a lot of the documentation and statistics which has been presented to this court in the reply brief are self-serving statistics presented by representatives of the Imperial Valley to the Senate committee last year and the year before.
And you say that has passed the Senate, did you say?
It did. In December of 1979, S-14 passed the Senate. In September 14, 1979, it passed the Senate. I believe, in fact, last week, hearings were held before the appropriate subcommittee of the House Interior Committee on that very legislation.
If that passes, is that going to be the end of this problem?
That's the end of the ballgame, Your Honor. In fact,
suppose it passed tomorrow, would the case just be moved?
I think so. The bill was introduced shortly after the Ninth Circuit made its decision. There's been an effort made to change the law westwide because of this and a number of other cases, and the specific exemption has been carried for the Imperial Valley. I might point out that, as far as I recall, that is the only geographical area that has a specific exemption. The other areas, their qualifications.
Where is the bill in the House before the end of the committee?
Yes, there have been hearings held in Sacramento, California a few months ago, and hearings were held this past week.
Does the House have its own bill, or is the hearing on the Senate bill?
It's my understanding the hearing is on the Senate bill, S-14. I would like to point out that this litigation does not seek to take away any of this subsidy that's been provided to the landowners of the Imperial Valley in the past. No one is seeking to recoup the water or its value. The case concerns the right and entitlement to future water deliveries. And we seek to have a determination as to whom the water is to be delivered. The continuing nature of the subsidy must be borne in mind when we consider the arguments on administrative practice and the non-legal issue, which has been urged by the landowners, the non-legal issue of fairness. While I don't believe it is a proper legal issue, I'd like to address myself to it because, as my worthy opponent points out, it seems to be the core of this very case. Fairness, at most, is a variation of the equitable estoppel argument. The landowners contend that they rely to their detriment upon a ruling by Secretary Wilbur.
Well, I hadn't understood that to be their precise contention, Counsel. I had understood that they had thought that Secretary Wilbur's construction of the Act was a permissible construction, if not the only one, and that under Swift and Company and cases like that, after it had gone on for a period of time, it represented a very significant canon of statutory construction rather than simply a straight estoppel argument.
Well, I think the argument is twofold. I think it covers both parts of Your Honor's hypothesis. In the first instance, from the time I became involved in this litigation, they have argued the reasonableness of Secretary Wilbur. There's been evidence offered in either this case or the residency case, and I forget which one, of how some of the landowners heard Secretary Wilbur and they heard Congressman Swing and what have you, and they were promised.
But Secretary Wilbur wrote an opinion letter of about six pages long.
2.5 pages, Your Honor, the Wilbur opinion.
Well, perhaps letter. I was reading a different, in one appendix or the other, it comprises several pages.
That, if I may correct Your Honor, that's a collection of documents which are appended to the opinion of former Solicitor Barry. And the Wilbur letter is about 2.5 pages.
Well, okay, be that as it may.
But the short answer is, number one, that if there is anything unfair or inequitable about enforcing congressional policy and seeing that the federal water subsidy is delivered to the people to whom it was intended is, as this court indicated in Gerlach and Ivanhoe, the landowner should go to the Court of Claims.
But we first have to determine what congressional policy was here, whether these acreage limitation was intended to apply in the Imperial Valley.
Okay. I'll move over to the Imperial Valley situation, which is the Boulder Canyon Act. And the argument is made that because of present perfected rights, Congress intended a shorthand reference to a specific exemption from the acreage limitation. Let me start at this point. In Ivanhoe, this court handed down the rule and decided the rule of statutory construction, that where there has been an exemption from the acreage limitation, Congress has always made that exception explicitly. This is set out on pages 90 and 91 of our brief. Examples of an express exemption are far different than the hidden esoteric meanings that we find in the Boulder Canyon Act that are urged by the petitioners. In one statute, it says, the excess land provisions of the federal reclamation laws shall not be applicable. That's clear and concise. In another statute, it says, except as provided in Section 2 of this Act, the excess land provisions of the federal reclamation laws shall not apply. In yet another statute, it says, the excess land provisions of the federal reclamation laws shall not be applicable. There is no such language in the Boulder Canyon Project Act. As a matter of fact, in preparing for the argument today, I was rereading Arizona versus California, and we come to the only specific reference that I have found as to the reason for the inclusion of Section 14. Section 14, as your honors know, is the section which incorporates reclamation law by reference, standard language which is found in every reclamation statute. Mr. Justice Harlan, in his dissent, this is at 373 U.S. at page 623, he points out that both Representative Swing and Senator Johnson emphasized that this provision, Section 14, was deliberately incorporated into the Project Act. Now, nobody in this case has yet come up with a reason for the inclusion of Section 14. The petitioners have not pointed out any meaning to Section 14. It's mere surplusage. They claim that everything is otherwise provided because there's a specific manner of contracting in Section 4B. Well, obviously, we're dealing with a multi-state project here, the largest project of its day. But there's nothing in Section 4B that says this shall be an exemption from the excess land laws of the reclamation law. So Section 14 has no meaning at all, according to the petitioners.
But you have an express administrative construction that went on for 30 years.
An administrative construction which was wrong?
Well,
we
you say it was wrong.
Well,
but it has to be absolutely totally wrong, as I understand the law. And if one reads Solicitor Berry's opinion as opposed to Secretary Wilbur's opinion, you see that it seems to me that in the reference to the various land division opinions, one construed vested rights more narrowly than the other. It's not a case of black and white at all.
Well, I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. I am not the only person who has asserted that the Wilbur letter was dead wrong, absolutely wrong, as a matter of black-letter law. The Ninth Circuit was charitable when it referred to the Wilbur letter as a rather simplistic analysis. There has never been one legal analysis or evaluation of the Wilbur letter from the time it was prepared for the Secretary's signature, which has upheld its legal reasoning. Not a one.
Mr. Brunner, can I ask you, suppose the All-American Canal had been built before the Boulder Dam project was even thought of, and that they had a big head gate on the Colorado, and Project Act comes along and they're going to preempt the headgate. And so the Imperial Valley people say, you must protect us in this, you must agree to deliver. And they say, well, we will. And so they write in the Project Act that we will satisfy perfected rights. And when the dam is built, they contract to deliver to Imperial Valley the water that had previously been taken out through the All-American Canal. Now, would you still be making the same argument?
I'd have to have more details, Mr. Justice White. In the first place, if the people of the Imperial Valley were taking the water from the river, and then along comes the government mm-hmm. and blocks off their rights, mm-hmm. then the landowner, nothing more, mm-hmm. the landowners would have a claim mm-hmm. for condemnation and a taking under the Gerlach case.
If they went to the government and said, you're going to be taking our water. And the government says, no, I'm going to take your water. I'm going to deliver it. I'm going to give it back to you. When the project is built, you're going to be taking your water out of the project.
Is Your Honor trying to summarize what is happened in this case or in a hypothetical?
I thought it was a plain and simple question.
If the government says that and the government allows the previously delivered appropriated waters to go through the federally financed canal, the acreage limitation must apply. If the government says no, it won't apply, they're doing what Secretary Wilbur did.
But if the All-American Canal had been built before and it was not financed by the project at all, nevertheless, project water is delivered to the Imperial Valley through the All-American Canal.
Through the privately financed canal?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a matter of contract then. I think that's a matter of contract.
Suppose this contract, the only contract that was made is the contract that was in this case.
Yes.
And then the project and the provisions of the statutes are precisely the same. I would suppose you'd be here making the same argument.
The distinction, Mr. Justice White, is that in the case at Bar, it's a federally constructed canal. The water...
I understand that. But now, how about my question? Suppose it had been privately financed. Would you be here making this argument?
I don't think I would if it was a privately financed irrigation project.
Although the provisions of the contract, provisions of the statute, provisions of the Reclamation Act would be precisely the same.
Well, there is a case where that comes close to the hypothetical. It deals with the San Luis Project in the Central Valley of California where there's a dam and a reservoir which is constructed jointly by the United States in the state of California. And there is a solicitor's opinion by Solicitor Barry that the acreage limitation would not apply to the service area serviced by the state-financed canal, even though the water in the jointly constructed reservoir comes from both places. So that comes close to your situation.
So you wouldn't be here making the argument if the All-American Canal had been privately financed, even though the contract would be exactly the same contract as present here, and the acts would say exactly the same thing.
Well, of course, there wouldn't be that kind of contract because the contract is not only to deliver water. The contract is to construct the canal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the contract provided in the Project Act. Mm-hmm. It isn't simply the secretary saying, I will deliver X acre-feet of water to this water district.
What about the land office decision in the Wright case that Secretary Wilbur relied upon, which Solicitor Barry simply said is inapplicable here? Do you think that's totally inapplicable?
I'm not going to be able to respond in detail. I can just tell you that was gone into a trial with Mr. Weinberg's testimony, the government's expert witness.
Well, we're here deciding whether or not Secretary Wilbur's construction was a plausible or reasonable one. He relied on a couple of land office decisions which talked about vested rights, and Solicitor Barry said no, he was probably shouldn't have relied on them.
As I recall those cases...
That's part of the question we're answering here.
As I understand those cases, the two lands cases discussed in the Wilbur letter, they refer to situations where the water had been delivered and there was no new delivery system that provided the water to Anna Wright and the other people who asked for an exemption. In the Imperial Valley, there was a new delivery system. It has to be borne in mind that the water, under the pre-existing situation, went into Mexico and then back into the United States. And there was no canal constructed by the government.
Well, I can understand that as a perfectly plausible reason if you're arguing a case to say, no, the Wright opinion doesn't apply. But it doesn't seem to me that that means that the Wright opinion simply had no applicability whatever, and that Secretary Wilbur was just almost out of his mind in citing it.
Well, according to Mr. Weinberg, Secretary Wilbur, not to use that phraseology, but he was wrong because the practice had always been that when you bring in a federal project, vested rights under state law do not exempt the landowners from the acreage limitation. That was the rule, and that was a rule agreed to, which was set out in one of Mr. Dent's memoranda in 1927 and to a solicitor's opinion in 1927. And it turns out that once in a while in a project, you'll have one or two people who are right there, right next to the existing stream, and the stream isn't changed. But the government will take water out of the stream, and the stream is then appropriated, and they allow these people to use the water. But that's a far different situation than the Imperial Valley, where everybody was using the water, and they went to Congress. The water program was not satisfactory. They couldn't continue to use it. They had periodic droughts and floods, in addition to the revolutionary conditions in Mexico, and they had to have this project. I mean, any claim that they relied upon this project and they wouldn't have approved it is really absurd. One only has to go to the dam site or to Boulder City and look at the movie that gives the history of the background of this project to see the devastation that existed in the Imperial Valley before this project was built. I'd like to return to present perfected rights one moment.
And by the way, on the question of presently perfected right, do you think the government could have charged the irrigation district, the Imperial Valley Irrigation District, anything for the water?
Not under Section 1. Section 1 specifically says they're not going to charge for the water, and they haven't charged for the water. They charged for the construction of the canal.
Because it was a presently perfected right.
No, I don't agree that that's the reason. Because under Gerlach, the government appropriated pre-existing water, vested water rights under state law, and there was a valid claim presented in the Court of Claims.
Of course, this is a statutory. The Project Act provided for...
For the exemption,
observing presently perfected rights.
Yes, but as this court said in Arizona...
Well, would it have been inconsistent with that to charge for the water?
I don't think
so. Inconsistent with that section to charge for the water?
I don't believe so, because it's one thing to deliver water, it's another thing to charge for it. And this court said very clearly in Arizona, California, that nothing in the compact purports to control any distribution of water within a state. And as I read this court's opinion, it simply concluded that the present perfected rights of the users in the lower basin are to be satisfied out of the storage facilities in Lake Mead. In other words, if in days where there may be a water shortage, the people in the upper basin can't withdraw sufficient water to prevent the present perfected rights from accumulating in Lake Mead behind the dam. But there's nothing in the statute or in the compact which says word one about the acreage limitation. I would like to move to one issue raised by Mr. Chief Justice Berger, the question of standing. In this case, there is a unique statute, Section 46. It's a unique statute which doesn't apply anywhere else in the law. There's an entire body of case law in the Ninth Circuit dealing with attempts to litigate, individuals' attempts to litigate Reclamation Act cases.
This is Section 46 of the Act?
Yes, Your Honor. There's been some allusion to these cases in the briefs of Turner versus Kings River Conservation District, Bowker versus Morton, and the two cases at Bar. And significantly, Chief Judge Browning was on three of those panels. He was on all panels with the exception of Bowker versus Morton. Under Section 14, there will be an automatic drop in the price of land because one shouldn't be allowed to benefit from the federal water subsidy. There may be a dispute as to what level that price is going to drop. Would it be, in this case, to 1942, when the district ceased using water from the Alamo Canal, or today, when there is no longer water available from the Alamo Canal? But the fact remains that there definitely would be a drop in price, and it would be to below market levels. The Secretary has proposed a series of regulations which are set out verbatim in the district's appendix to their major brief, which show how the Secretary intends to carry out and to enforce the acreage limitation. And he quite clearly states we're going to carry out the congressional purpose of creating small family farms, wide distribution of the benefits, and the rest of it. The respondents in this case have an opportunity to purchase some of the richest farmland in the world at below market prices. The Secretary has set up a list of priorities about how to qualify to be what he refers to as a non-excess landowner. You have to live there, you have to promise to farm, you have to intend to farm. My clients qualify. Instead of there being 150 to 200 large landowners controlling essentially all the excess land in the Imperial Valley, with an average holding of 715 acres of irrigated farms in California, and my clients for the past 40 years could have been essentially 1,600 fruit pickers, because instead of getting the water to engage in farming, they're out picking the crops. Now, that isn't what Congress intended. We will get
the qualifications of your clients to purchase depend at all on the price at which the land is offered?
It doesn't, Your Honor, because
they can pay whatever price is asked.
No, the landowner does not have the right to set a price.
We don't know yet what the price will be.
No, but we know it's going to be at below market prices, and we could use our common sense to anticipate that that's going to be pretty cheap for this kind of farmland. Then there are federal programs available that we have made allusion to in our brief for borrowing funds if necessary. Certainly the doctor.
What would motivate a seller to sell at less than market price?
Because the testimony in this record, in answer to questions from their own counsel, the landowner said that there is no use for that land except farming. There's under 2 inches of rain a year. Unless they wanted to raise rattlesnakes and rabbits.
Well, or maybe they want to wait and see what the House of Representatives does with S-14.
Well, that may be, but, you know, life is full of imponderables like that. This Court recognized
that. Would you sell at about a fourth of market price if you owned the land?
If I owned 14,000 acres like Mr. Elmore, the typical Imperial Valley farmer that's been referred to by the petitioners, and I had thousands of dollars worth of improvements in my land, as they claim they have, and I know that the law, as determined by the Ninth Circuit in Tulare, provides that the value of the improvements will be taken into consideration in setting the fair and reasonable ex-contract price, I would be very reluctant to sit back and let my 14,000 acres return to desert.
What roughly, in your judgment, is the spread between the fair market value of the land with water and the price at which it will be sold per acre? What's the range?
I don't know, because we entered the case as interveners. And we didn't enter.
But your standing depends on opinion, at least, as to the likelihood of making a purchase.
But the record to date shows that the value of land without the water is $25 to $50 an acre.
Right.
And the value with the water is $1,200 to $1,400 an acre.
And that, yeah. Does that, what light does that shed on the question I had? My first question is the likelihood of an owner selling at that very reduced price when there's a statute or a bill pending in Congress that would restore the full value of the land.
Well, number
which
one,
which already passed one body of Congress.
Well, number one, if the bill passes Congress, that's the end of the case. But I don't know that the court may decide the case based upon the possibility that Congress may change the law. So I think we have to assume that the law will continue as it is in determining, you know, the question on its merits, the case on its merits, as well as the procedural questions. It would seem to me that the spread is between $50 and $1,200. With respect to the improvements, I don't know. And the landowners and the district did not offer any conflicting affidavits in the trial court to show what the value of the improvements would have been. So the only record before this court is that the...
What are these improvements? What are we talking about?
Oh, they build ditches. They line the ditches to keep the water from seeping down too far. I think the irrigation district simply brings the water to a certain place, and then the landowner has to take the water somewhere else. And there's machinery, of course.
Some of which, I suppose, would be retained on the 160-acre plots that they could retain.
Well, if you want to engage in farming, you would. Although there are ways where...
I take it your standing argument does, at least correct to this, that does depend on an assumption that the owners would sell at the reduced price.
That a substantial number of them would.
Or maybe just one might be enough for
you. Even one would be enough. Yeah. And I don't think it's necessary that we make the tender of $25 to $50 to Mr. Elmore, Mr. Chief Justice Berger, to... ask him to refuse our offer for some of this rich farmland. You know, I don't think we should have to do a useless act.
Your time has expired now.
Thank you.
Counsel, do you have anything further?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I have only one brief remark in rebuttal. The Solicitor General has referred to the passage of S-14 in the Senate and has stated that if there is any unfairness here, it should be to Congress to deal with it. And the respondents have made the same argument. I would like to advise this Court that when the landowners of Imperial Valley first went to Congress, they could not know in advance that this Court would eventually grant certiorari. And when a bill was pending in Congress 2 years ago, they did take efforts to seek a provision dealing explicitly with them. But that does not render the case moot before this Court. The present administration has taken a position consistently in Congress and all the proceedings on S-14 that Congress should not act. Secretary Andrus has 3 times told Congress it should not act because it should be decided by this Court. And I quote from Secretary Andrus's testimony in 1978 to the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, quote, "I would prefer to have this resolved in the Supreme Court of the United States because it is the highest court of the land." Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Mohawk.